We talk science, politics, and technology today. This morning we sat down with Rick Spinrad. He's the former chief scientist of NOAA and former research director for the U.S. Navy. He's in Honolulu to give a talk today at a seminar at the University of Hawaii as the new head of the Marine Technology Society.
So we are the Marine Technology Society, and it's important to recognize we are an international organization. And it's a professional society of scientists, technologists, and engineers who work in marine and maritime environments. So think about the people who are responsible for ensuring the safety of our ships, the people who are responsible for collecting data and information in the ocean that's then used for things like weather forecasts or surf forecasts or storm forecasts. It includes people who are working on many of the exciting new renewable energy concepts, waves, tides, offshore wind, that kind of thing. The roots of the organization start with the oil and gas industry, largely in the Gulf of Mexico, where roughly 60 years ago, people working in this industry were saying, we need to have a better understanding of how things work in the ocean. It's a dynamic environment. It's a hostile environment when you're putting things in there. And they recognized they needed professional help. So they agreed to organize themselves, like I say, about 60 years ago, to talk about things like how do we ensure the safety of oil rigs? How do we inspect the rigs? What kind of technology? And as a result, the way I like to think of it, the Marine Technology Society is the venue for facilitating both the pull of new technology, what applications like fisheries and oil and gas and national security and commercial shipping are going to draw the need for developing new scientific concepts. And at the same time, we facilitate the push of technology. So if different communities like the information technology community develops new concepts on how to acquire and assimilate data and store data and apply data, or how to build sophisticated computer models, we are there to say, hey, that's a really cool idea. How does it apply to our needs in the marine environment? So it's all things marine. It's focused on science and technology. And like most professional societies, we conduct meetings throughout the year around the world. We have about 2,000 members around the world from about 30 different countries. Many of our members are students, so we work hard to set up student sections. We have local geographic sections, including here in Hawaii, where we've been trying to stimulate even more activity, engage folks even more, and get the word out about what we're doing.
Now, renewable energy is a big deal here in Hawaii, and I know the offshore wind turbines are kind of a novel idea. I think they've got some things going in Europe, maybe something in Atlantic, but nothing in
that's
the
right.
Pacific yet, I think.
That's true. There's a lot of activity in wind and offshore wind throughout. The interesting thing I would say is that when we talk renewables in the marine environment, and especially if you look at the history here in Hawaii, there's been a lot of attention to other kinds of renewable energy. So at Kaneohe, we have the wave energy project that the Navy's been so actively involved in. Off the island of Hawaii, we have had for many, many years the what's called OTEC, the Ocean Thermal Energy Conversion Study, which looks at how can we generate energy by taking advantage of the temperature difference between the surface warm waters and the deep colder waters. So there's a rich legacy in a variety of different way or different renewable energy concepts here in Hawaii, which makes sense given the energy costs here in the state of Hawaii, that this be a good place to develop these new technologies.
And what's your sense as to whether offshore wind is feasible? Because there are a lot of concerns that the military
sure.
has as far as placement of these things.
Exactly. And there's a lot of what's referred to as NIMBY, not in my backyard, concerns. We saw that off the East Coast where there was recognition that there was an abundant supply, if you will, of energy, a lot of wind. And the concern was, how would this affect the environment? How would this affect the aesthetics of the area? So my view is we've got the technology very well in hand. All you have to do is look around the island of Oahu, for example, to see where the wind farms are being placed. You see it on the mainland. So we understand the technology of turbine development and how to make it very efficient. The challenge of putting these systems offshore is not unlike oil and gas, making sure they are safely secured, making sure they don't affect the ecology. How does a wind farm, offshore wind farm, affect migration routes of humpback whales, for example? Those are important questions to ask. And then, of course, the other interesting challenge, I would say, here in Hawaii is that while there is abundant wind, the water gets very deep very quickly. You don't have to go very far offshore before you're in thousands and thousands of feet of water. And so being able to position and locate wind energy devices is going to be a critical consideration in light of the very rapid deepening of the coast here in this state.
And you mentioned the humpback whales, and you have ties to this area in a previous job because you had the hat as the chief scientist for NOAA under the Obama administration. So you're familiar with our waters.
I am. I'm familiar not just with the waters, but with a lot of the land area as well. As you said, I was honored to have been appointed by President Obama to be the chief scientist at NOAA, and in that capacity, we had responsibility for management of all of the National Marine Sanctuaries, including the Humpback Whales National Marine Sanctuary. I can tell you I had the very special honor and treat of being able to swim with the humpbacks a few years ago when I was the head of research at NOAA, all according to regulations.
Yeah,
so I want to make sure listeners recognize there was no harassment of the marine mammals. But you developed such an extraordinary tie to these amazing animals when you're actually able to be with them in their environment. And, of course, those sanctuaries now are even more important in light of impacts of climate change, pollution. The changes that these animals are seeing in their homes, effectively, are very important for us to understand. But I wanted to add, since I said the land area as well, part of my responsibility when I was the head of research at NOAA was to oversee the Mauna Loa Atmospheric Observatory, another jewel in the crown, if you will, of our observational system for understanding atmosphere and what's happening with carbon dioxide in conjunction with climate change.
And so, yeah, Mauka Kea Mackay, you've got your ties with our area.
Sure. Yeah, this brings us back to the Marine Technology Society. There's some extraordinary engineering capacity here in the state and some really impressive developments. I mean, after all, this is the only state that is a collection of islands, and consequently, attention to and adherence to all the needs for marine technology. It's part of every Hawaiian's life. No matter what they're doing, it impacts what they do.
And we just had an observation conference.
Yes, the Ocean Obs Conference. Mm-hmm. In fact, I had the opportunity to listen to the interview that you did of one of the attendees, a good friend of mine, Chris Sabine. Yes, that's a decadal conference that's done. It's been done in Europe. This was the first time it's been done in the Pacific.
How are you looking at the current climate with NOAA and attempts by this current administration to maybe move in a different direction than, you know, where we were at with the Obama administration?
So the way I look at it, all of this environmental work that's done, not just by NOAA, but let's talk about NOAA, focuses on three real major areas of impact, and I like to characterize it as lives, livelihoods, and quality of life. And what I mean is the really good research that's being done at places like NOAA will affect the safety of people. So a better tsunami forecast, for example, that's the lives part. Livelihoods translates to economic development. So one of the real issues we have here in the state of Hawaii is aquaculture. How much can NOAA's research improve the productivity, the quality of the shrimp and other kinds of foods that are developed through aquaculture and mariculture? That's the livelihoods piece. And then the quality of life is really considering environmental changes and environmental impact. This is a gorgeous state, some of the most beautiful beaches in the world. How do we ensure that it stays that way, that the quality, the water quality, the beach quality is maintained? Coastal resiliency is the catchphrase that we use. How do we ensure that there's no threats, no insults, as we say, to the coastal environment? So where I'm going with this is that I think different administrations emphasize different aspects of that that triad of lives, livelihood, and quality of life. And this current administration is very focused on economic development. And so consequently, I think a lot of the work that's being done at NOAA, we need to think of perhaps a little bit more in terms of the economic development and how it will affect workforce and jobs and growth of the economy, more so than we may have had to focus in other administrations. I'd say more so than we focused when I was there as chief scientist.
What do you think the biggest challenge is going to be when it comes to rolling out some of this new technology and protecting the resource?
I honestly believe the greatest challenge is building awareness on the part of the public writ large, perhaps less so in a state like Hawaii than trying to convince the farmers in Kansas of the impact that they're having on the oceans. But until the public, who basically pays the bills by paying their taxes, recognizes the seriousness and the direct impact of the environment and any changes to the environment, to their lives and livelihood and quality of life, it's always going to be hard to make the compelling argument that this is something we should invest in. And if you look at the history of policy around environment, a lot of times the biggest changes in appropriations, how much money goes into it, or focus, how much attention goes into it, are a consequence of natural disasters or some really significant and really obvious event. A bad hurricane in the southeast raises awareness. Why can't we improve our hurricane forecast capability? Okay, we'll invest some more, and it will take time, and we'll do that. But honestly, I think coming full circle here, what we really need to do is make sure that we engage the public, listen to the public, what they need, what their concerns are, and share the value of what's going on in marine technology and marine research with them. I give a talk to lay audiences on that I call How Oceanography Saved the World. And I feel it's important people recognize that what is done in the ocean, in research and technology, affects each and every one of the global population, but certainly the 330 million Americans.
Now, you know, there's a lot of emphasis now on getting back into space and, you know, pioneering and charting, you know, uncharted areas. We just had a scientist in here last week talking about, you know, how fish mm-hmm. communicate with each other. And, you know, he shared doing that work. You know, he sat under, you know, the bottom of the ocean for 3 hours, basically videotaping and listening to what fish are doing on the reef. And he said it's like being on the moon, exploring the moon, because a lot of it is just uncharted territory. I mean, we just don't know enough about what's happening in our oceans.
So there's, by some estimates, up to 1 million undiscovered species in the ocean. NOAA has a program called the Ocean Exploration Program. They have a dedicated ship, the Okeanos Explorer, whose whole purpose is to explore, go out and look for things. On every cruise that ship undertakes, no matter if it's in the Pacific or in the Atlantic or anywhere else in the world, they make discoveries. Every single cruise, new organisms, new fish. It's not just the if you will, obscure microorganisms. It's huge, large megafauna. It's fish. It's just about everything you could imagine. The other interesting thing, which is I could argue a bit more practical than the gee whiz aspect of finding new fish and new animals, is that half of the anti-cancer drug discoveries come from marine organisms or marine compounds. Think about that. Half of the anti-cancer drug discoveries, many of which are making it to market now. There's a drug that's being used for treatment of breast cancer that comes from sponges and corals. So consequently, these discoveries have direct implications for the public. And I really am excited about and have a lot of respect for my space scientist colleagues. I would argue that we can see the fruits of our discoveries in the ocean much more immediately. And I'd also argue, and this gets me in trouble with them sometimes, that it's actually much harder to explore in the ocean than it is in deep space because of the constraints of the environment.
I just wonder, maybe you can share, because you were, you know, within NOAA, you know, is there a tension between funding programs, let's say, with climate versus basic marine science?
Not really. I don't see you don't see that knockdown, drag-out fight about give me the dollar, no, give me the dollar. But I do think what's happened of late in the last 10 or 20 years is a lot more pressure on the scientific community for accountability. Why should we spend a dollar on space research or underwater research or biomedicine, for that matter, if you can't show me what the end value will be for the public? Is this going to save lives? Is this going to improve the economy? That kind of thing. And so scientists have gotten a lot smarter about figuring that out. What it's also meant is that in fields like marine technology, which are very much physics and math oriented, we've recognized the need to bring in some of the social scientists, people who can look at how economics plays into the equation, or actually behavioral sciences plays into the equation. Think about this. Let's talk about something immediately relevant here in Hawaii, and that's tsunami warnings. So we can get the physicists and mathematicians and computer scientists say, I've built the best model, and I can tell you exactly when that tsunami coming from an earthquake in the West Pacific is going to hit Oahu. But if we don't understand how people will react to the warnings or not react to the warnings, then that scientific, that physical information may not be of value. So we have to ask the behavioral scientists and the economists, how do we translate this physical information into a meaningful understanding for the public?
Right, because you want real-world action, I guess.
Sure.
Otherwise, there's some serious consequences.
And a lot of times, the oceanographers and the meteorologists don't think about how that plays out. I'll give you one specific example we saw in the Midwest, and it was about tornado warnings. So for many, many years, the tornado warning lead time was not very long, just a couple of minutes. And now it's out about 12 minutes, and the meteorologists think we might be able to get that to 15, maybe 20 minutes. And they're saying, wouldn't it be great to get it to 30 minutes? And the behavioral scientists are saying, no, because what happens is at 15 minutes, people say, I better find shelter. I better go collect my kids and make sure we're all safe. When you get past 20 minutes, people tend to say, hey, you know, I got a little extra time. Maybe I'll go down and get that quart of milk at the convenience store and actually put themselves in danger. And so that's a good example of where the physical scientists, the meteorologists, need to get together with the behavioral scientists. So we need to do some of that as well.
Okay, so get out of those silos.
Exactly.
Let's talk.
All right.
All right, well, thank you so much for sitting down with us. We really
appreciate
it.
My pleasure. My pleasure. And thank you for your interest in the Marine Technology Society. The last comment I'll make is that we are really working hard to strengthen and build up the footprint of the Marine Technology Society here in Hawaii. And we've got some great folks at UH and at the various industries here and the government labs, and it's really going to be fun to watch how that grows. We had our big conference here in 2001 and 2011. Let's get it back here again in a few years.
Okay. All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That was Rick Spinrad, former chief scientist at NOAA, who has taken over as the new head of the Marine Technology Society. He's in town for a seminar being held at the NOAA headquarters at Ford Island and at the University of Hawaii.